I think a better way to deal with it right now would be to vigorously enforce it.
Senator Dan Sullivan advises staying with the Iran nuclear agreement after President Trump threatens to end it. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Department of Defense changes enlistment requirements for immigrants.
We're not going to have enough people who are qualified to serve in our nation's military. We need people who speak foreign languages and have cultural expertise and can blend in with local populations, and now we're not going to have that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations. GCI is your partner in possibilities.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Just last month, Primera announced it would drop its health insurance rates on Alaska's individual market by more than 26%. But the drop may not be quite that steep after all, at least for one type of plan. The new factor is President Trump's decision last night to stop paying cost-sharing reductions. CSR is a type of subsidy under the Affordable Care Act. For certain low-income households, CSR lowers what they have to pay out of pocket when they see a doctor. Primera is the sole insurer on Alaska's individual market. It says it will still provide the out-of-pocket discounts to eligible customers as required by law. But to cover the cost, it will have to raise monthly premiums. Alaska Insurance Division Director Lori Wing-Hire says if the government eliminates the CSR payments, the rates for a silver plan in 2008 will go up 5 or 6%. From what they would have been. Low and middle income people who get a subsidy to help them pay their monthly premiums may not feel the increase. That kind of subsidy goes up as the premium goes up. But Trump's move could widen the federal deficit. The Congressional Budget Office says ending the CSR payments while continuing to subsidize premiums would actually cost the government billions of dollars each year. President Trump has mandated that Congress decide what to do with the Iran nuclear agreement. Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, was harshly critical of the agreement in 2005. He said then lifting sanctions would fuel the economy of a country that sponsors terrorism.
Billions are likely to be used to pump up their terror machine around the world and target American citizens.
He still doesn't like the agreement. He says it's too lenient on Iran. Still, Sullivan now says the U.S. should not back out of the deal.
I think a better way to deal with it right now would be to vigorously enforce it.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and other top security officials say Iran is in technical compliance. Similar to President Trump's comments today, Sullivan says Iran has violated the letter and spirit of the deal. He says the U.S. should give Iran time to change its ways.
And then we should undertake what President Obama and Secretary Kerry said we would do, which is apply snapback sanctions.
In 2015, though, Senator Sullivan mocked that as a workable solution when the Obama administration proposed it.
I know what we've heard from the administration. Don't worry. If there's a violation of this agreement, these sanctions will just snap back into place. They'll snap back. No problem. Piece of cake.
At that time, Sullivan said it takes years to impose sanctions and get companies and other nations to divest. One reason Sullivan gives for staying with the agreement now is to retain America's leadership position with allies who also signed the deal. He says several European countries are more interested in doing business in Iran than they are in containment. The Defense Department announced today changes to military recruiting that will make it harder for legal immigrants to enlist and qualify for citizenship. The new policy effectively ends the expedited track to citizenship for green card holders who enter the military, eliminating the incentive for many to enlist. Another change is an end to a 2009 program called MAVNI.
MAVNI is Military Sessions Vital to the National Interest, and it's an immigrant recruiting program that has been suspended by the Pentagon.
Margaret Stock is a lawyer who practices immigration, citizenship, and military law. Last year, she ran for U.S. Senate as an independent. She's also a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel and a MacArthur Fellow. She says the MAVNI program is designed to bring immigrants with high-value skills into the military, for example, language and cultural fluency for operations abroad. Stock says recruitment of immigrants has been more restrictive since tighter green card standards were put in place in 2003. Today's change extends that.
It hurts our national security. It means we're not going to have enough people who are qualified to serve in our nation's military. We need people who speak foreign languages and have cultural expertise and can blend in with local populations. And now we're not going to have that. So it's a bad day for national security.
Stock says a number of new background screenings are being added for immigrant enlistees on top of those already required for green card eligibility and to qualify for military service. This comes at a time when there's a backlog for completing security clearances at the Office of Personnel Management. The Pentagon says green card holders entering the military could be waiting up to a year to start their service. Stock says it's now faster for immigrants seeking citizenship to just remain civilians. The Pentagon, in a release, says the changes ensure higher security among prospective service members and potential citizens. According to Stephanie Miller, the Defense Department's chief of accessions, the change will affect some current personnel who weren't finished with security screenings when they began to serve. Certifications that counted toward citizenship for those individuals will be nullified. Stock says a number of Alaskans stand to be affected by the change. Some immigrants who have lived in Anchorage have been among those to join the military through the MAVNI program. They include Specialist Susan Tenoi, a native of Kenya and former All-American runner at UAA, who was the first place female finisher in the Army's 10-mile race in Washington, D.C. last weekend. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Port Hyden residents work to combat damage from coastal erosion.
High winds are becoming more frequent. We know that bad weather is hanging around a lot longer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
Love what you hear on this station? Consider becoming a member.
A former Alaska resident who now lives in Northern California is waiting to learn if his home will survive the wildfires. Clark Mishler, a professional photographer, lived and worked in Anchorage for more than 40 years. 2 years ago, Mishler and his wife moved to Calistoga to be near their daughters and grandkids. Mishler says Calistoga is the northernmost community in the Napa Valley. He says it's a small agricultural community of under 6,000, filled with hardworking people. He says they had to evacuate Tuesday night.
It's completely deserted. There are maybe 10 people in the entire town who are there, patrolling. And so far, there have been no structures burned within the Calistoga city limits. This weekend's going to be very critical, though, due to the fact that they're expecting some very high velocity winds. So, this whole thing can change in hours, and it could go from we're okay to, oh my God, everything's on fire in all directions.
You're a photographer, and you were taking photos before you left Calistoga. Tell us about some of what you captured.
I stuck around town photographing people as they prepared to leave. So I photographed, the people at the old folks' home, and they took them out pretty early on Monday, and got photographs of them leaving there. Some of them were in tears, not sure what's going on, and it was kind of sad. But then I came across other people, in the community who had, pretty much the same attitude which I did, which is, hey, we're alive, we're able to pack up our cars. That's a lot better than some people. There are stories of people who were woken up by this fireball that came through Santa Rosa. And they basically were awakened when they realized that their whole house was lit up inside from the fires outside the house. They literally ran out the front door in their pajamas, no shoes, no cell phone, no wallet, hopped in their cars, and drove off trying to outspeed these this fireball.
You also mentioned that there were a lot of folks helping out, a football team helping with emergency relief. What was going on there?
We're down here in East Bay, and yesterday we went over to Costco and we bought a bunch of supplies, and we took them over to a collection center in Vallejo. And the Vallejo football team there, high school football team, was there, along with a whole bunch of other volunteers. And they were doing, you know, all kinds of triage on these things, or they'd throw all the paper towels in one pile and all the water in another pile and all the Pampers in another pile. And then these volunteer trucks were rolling up, and they were filling up these trucks with these supplies. And then these trucks were taken off for Santa Rosa, and they were dropping the supplies off at the various centers where people were waiting, evacuation centers.
Clark, what have you been told about when you may be able to go back, or what's happening with containment efforts?
It wasn't until today that they now feel that they've got like 10% to up to as high as 27% containment on some of the fires. There's a number of major fires burning in the area. Some of them have zero containment. So this weekend, I think, is going to be real critical. We're expected to have some more winds, which are really the problem here. As long as the winds don't come back, they can surround these fires, they can do some burn, back burns, and they can stop the progression. But if they don't know which way the wind is going to be blowing, nor do they know what the velocity, they don't know how large to make that fire break. And so that's the problem. If you get the winds at the speeds that we had Sunday night, there's really no stopping it.
Clark Mishler is a former Anchorage resident who now lives in Northern California and had to evacuate his home earlier this week. Mishler is a professional photographer. His photos of the Calistoga area are at our website, alaskapublic.org. The Environmental Protection Agency was in the remote community of Iliamna yesterday for the second of two public hearings on whether the agency should roll back its Obama-era proposal to impose restrictions on the Pebble Mine. Despite pouring rain, more than 50 Alaskans from across the region filled seats in the old Crowley hangar at the Iliamna Airport and spoke directly to EPA officials. Unlike the hearing the day before in Dillingham, where public input was unanimously against the proposed Pebble Mine and EPA's new course, the reaction in Iliamna was more mixed. Representatives from Pebble Limited Partnership and the Alaska Miners Association spoke in favor of the project, and several local residents said they were hoping for more job opportunities in the region. That included Iliamna resident Margie Olympic, who has been employed by Pebble for 11 years.
I take pride from where I come from and what I was taught growing up. But I also know the value of having a job and supporting my family at this age. Fishing does not and could not support me and my family 12 months out of the year.
Olympic and others urged EPA to allow the project to begin the normal permitting process. But many speakers criticized EPA for considering rolling back the restrictions, voicing fears about the mine's potential impact on the Bristol Bay salmon fishery. Everett Thompson is a commercial fisherman from Naknek.
The only true economy with longevity is a renewable economy, and we have that. It is scary to keep investing into the fishery with an ever-looming threat of Pebble Mine. Please do what is right. Do not withdraw your Clean Water Act proposed determination.
Several speakers also criticized EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt for making the decision to settle with the Pebble Limited Partnership this spring without public input from local communities. EPA will take comment on its proposal until October 17th. Several Bering Sea storms have hit the coast of southwest Alaska hard this past week. For the village of Port Hyden on the Alaska Peninsula, that has meant accelerated erosion, an issue the village has been dealing with for years. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Trained monitors in the village measured 6 feet of erosion in some places from the most recent storms. Within the last year, they've measured 20 to 100 feet of erosion along different sections of coastline near Port Hyden. Jacqueline Christensen is the village brownfield coordinator. She says the shoreline seems to be eroding more quickly than it used to.
It seems more rapid
nowadays, because I think we have bigger tides, we have a lot more water volume, and we have a lot of pumice in our soil. It's like tooth decay or a cavity. It eats a lot quicker because it's porous material, and, I mean, water could just unearth it so fast and easy. A lot of that is accelerated by the storm.
It's a fight that Port Hyden has been waging for decades, to stay above water. They started building homes on higher ground away from Meshick, the old village site, in the 1980s. The last person moved out of the old village in 2008. But the solution is not as simple as abandoning the old town. First, there's the issue of what to do about the old buildings. Left alone, they would be washed into the sea and the debris would end up on Port Hyden's beaches. Last year, before the road washed away too much to drive heavy machinery on it, the village deconstructed a lot of those buildings.
It's a very hard thing to do. We've gotten a lot of backlash about it because it's emotional, because it's, you know, letting go of your home that you grew up in. But what other alternative do we have? We can't stop the force of nature, but we can do something about leaving less of a footprint to our ecosystem by not polluting it.
Then there's the loss of a safe harbor. John Christensen Jr. is the tribal council president and a commercial fisherman.
Our safe harbor for our boats is down past the old village. Once the erosion reaches the lake down there, it'll cut off. We won't have no more road to go down there, so we're going to have to figure out a different place to park our boats.
Finally, there's a continued erosion even in the new town. While the homes that people live in now, the village office and village store, are currently on stable ground, to get from the bluffs where the town lies to the beach where barges land and residents subsistence fish, the village has to regularly reconstruct beach access roads with a loader. More worrisome, erosion is getting to the roads near the school.
Maybe 3 years ago, there was flooding so bad by the school that the school bus had to take the school kids from the school to the flooded area because there was like a river channel of water on the road, and then carry the kids across the water, and then the other school bus was on the other side of the road, and they took the kids from there to their homes.
Port Hyden's fuel tank farm was relocated fewer than 2 years ago due to erosion concerns, but Jacqueline Christensen worries that its new position by the school might not keep it safe from erosion for long. Even as the village continues to march inland, she says there isn't a lot of talk about why the erosion is happening.
We don't really use the word climate change around here. We just know things are changing. We just know high winds are becoming more frequent. We know that bad weather is hanging around a lot longer. Don't really hear the elders or the local people talk about climate change or ocean acidification or global warming as much, because it seems like a foreign factor that we've never really had to understand before.
Whatever the cause, Jacqueline Christensen is optimistic that the community will stay motivated and find solutions. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, ghosts. Ketchikan is home to plenty of supernatural phenomena. That's the theory, at least, behind a new venture, Ketchikan Ghost Tours. KRBD's Layla Carey tagged along and has this report.
Like, you ever feel like somebody's watching you?
On a dark and misty night,
Ghost tour guide Kelly Cleese leads about a dozen people to some of downtown Ketchikan's haunted spaces. We start on Creek Street, the city's historic and rather shady red light district, built along the shores of Ketchikan Creek. Cleese explains that in its heyday, Creek Street boasted more than 30 brothels. And this was during Prohibition, so many of the houses had trap doors to bring in bootlegged liquor for their male clientele.
A lot of those men also found themselves being thrown out of those trap doors. So part of the history of this creek is that there were an awful lot of dead salmon and dead bodies.
Cleese says when she first arrived in Ketchikan, she was warned to never walk on Creek Street alone at night. She didn't heed that warning.
I'm from Chicago. I got a knife. We're fine. So I proceeded to walk down Creek Street alone at night one night, and I have never been more scared in my life because there are shadows everywhere. There is a weird energy happening in this place.
For example, Cleese says there are reports of ghostly shadows and noises inside Dolly's house. That Creek Street home, now a private museum, belonged to Dolly Arthur, Ketchikan's most well-known sporting woman. Other former brothels on the creek, now shops, reportedly are home to ghosts that move displays around during the night. As we walk along the boardwalk, a light suddenly flickers.
Ghosts! What? Light just came on. Ghosts.
Or maybe a motion-activated security light?
You gotta open up your imagination on a night like this, you know? What's real? What's not? What's ghosts? What's automated lights? You never know.
The ghost tour is the brainchild of Diane Fast, a musician who recently moved to Ketchikan. She says she'd taken ghost tours in other cities and always had fun.
But I just noticed how much people enjoy ghost tours, and I've enjoyed them myself. And I was like, wow, we could totally do one here. It'd be really cute. And then that spawned the idea for an entire walking tour company.
Some of the other walking tours Fast offered over the summer got more interest from tourists, but the ghost tour appealed mostly to local residents, and that's who was on the tour with Cleese. The next stop after Creek Street is Ketchikan's original hospital, next to the Episcopalian Church on Mission Street. That 100-plus-year-old building was vacant for a long time and fell into disrepair, but now is under renovation by historic Ketchikan. Cleese says people don't like to go upstairs alone.
There's an energy in there that apparently, the quote is, you could cut it with a knife.
As Cleese finishes up her story about the old hospital, a woman on the tour tells her own story about the former Bon Marché building across the street. She worked there in the late 1990s. She didn't want to give her name, but said it was okay to use the story.
A couple of us would work after hours, and we'd hear kids running. More than once, we came upstairs because we worked below ground. More than once, we came upstairs trying to see who got into the building. To the point that nobody ever worked after hours by themselves.
Another stop for a future ghost tour. Fast says she's not absolutely sure ghosts are real, but she is sure there are things in the world that we don't or can't understand.
I've had experiences that I can't really quite explain, although I don't claim to know, you know, what if it's an actual person that's haunting a place, or is it just residual energy, like when you take a Polaroid photograph, or I have no idea, but it's fascinating and people are interested in it.
One of the last stops on the ghost tour is the Gilmore Hotel, where there are reports of actual ghostly people. Cleese says a man in a top hat and a woman make regular appearances, not at the same time.
So this top hat man apparently is pretty friendly, but likes to creep people out in one specific room. I believe it's 208. And he just sits there very peacefully. There's another woman who sits in a chair very peacefully.
Cleese says it's not clear who the Gilmore ghosts were. They're in good company, though, with all the other ghosts haunting Alaska's first city. For AK, I'm Layla Carey.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Mia Kennard in Anchorage. Kennard moved to Alaska from South Carolina a little over a year ago.
I came here for change and to give my boys a different environment to live in, to shut them off from so many things that they had access to in the lower 48. I met a great, I'm talking about an awesome group of nurses and care team at the Heart Institute, Alaska Heart Institute, and over at Alaska Regional Hospital. They took really good care of me, and they did things that wouldn't get done in the South. I kept having chest pains, and I made a request for a stress test, and they said, well, because of my age, I guess, they were saying that they only request stress tests when there's a red flag for it. Well, when I came here and I requested, they did a bunch of tests. Before I left the ER, they were calling me to schedule the stress test. That was the awesome part, too, because they didn't waste time and weeks to call me. They were calling me before I left the emergency room. But a minute into the stress test, I started having a heart attack. And in South Carolina, they would have just sent me home, told me, they kept sending me home, telling me to, you know, eat a lot of oranges and bananas, take an iron supplement. So my life was saved by coming here. And, you know, that's the most to be grateful for. Just to see different faces. I feel like in the lower 48 down south, we see a lot of Mexican, Black, White, you know, Asian. But then you come here, you have, you know, the other cultures, the Indians, the Natives, and the Samoans. They shock me. I like seeing them. So, yeah, I feel like we got, you know, the whole thing in a box. But the thing I like the most is to ride around and see the mountains. It's a beautiful sight. It's like every shot looks like it belongs in a picture frame. What I don't like about it is not having much to do. I'm not an outdoorsman person because I couldn't see going in the woods. Y'all have moose and bears.
Mia Kennard lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Layla Carey and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Iliamna, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and services to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.